Hello, I'm Steve Evans. Welcome to Business Daily. Coming up, is there a capitalist conspiracy to use disasters to promote business?
This new economy has dot-com levels of wealth, but CIA levels of discretion.
Stuff and nonsense, says one of President Bush's business evangelizers.
It is completely false to say that capitalists are anxious for disaster so they can make more money.
Conspiracy or muddled thinking? You decide in Business Daily from the BBC. Now, it's hard to define the movement against globalization. It's a gathering of differing, often contradictory viewpoints. Manufacturing labor unions in rich countries alongside anarchists, whatever that may mean, alongside, I suppose, nostalgic leftists, alongside thoughtful people, uneasy at unfettered capitalism. Now, one of the big thinkers about globalization from that side of the spectrum is Naomi Klein, whose book No Logo became a manifesto for anti-globalization. Now she's written a new book, I suppose, of equal weight. It's called The Shock Doctrine, The Rise of Disaster Capitalism. And it argues that ideologues of the right, particularly in what's known as the Chicago School, founded by Milton Friedman and others, they use disasters like war to further their cause. Does then she think there's an active plan, a conspiracy almost?
It's not a conspiracy in the sense of planning the crisis so that they can be exploited, but it is a philosophy of power in the sense that when the crisis hits, this movement, this campaign, is absolutely ready to act. For instance, after Hurricane Katrina hit, you had the Heritage Foundation hosting a meeting less than 2 weeks later and coming up with a list of 32 free market solutions for Hurricane Katrina, and George Bush adopting them within hours.
But doesn't that make it sound more sinister than it might be?
It makes it sound exactly as sinister as it is.
But what I mean is, war changes lots of things. War changes politics, the extreme crisis. You think of the Soviet Union in the Second World War. Well, that wasn't a reach out to capitalism. That was a reach out to the state way of doing things. Think of the Nazis. It was a way of consolidating their way of doing things.
Well,
so
I
what you then get
that
with Bush is, excuse me, what you then get with Bush is, because he is an arch capitalist, he reaches out for his way of doing things in time of crisis. No more than that.
You're absolutely right. I think all ideologues who believe in a totalitarian vision of society adore a crisis. And it's interesting that your examples are the Nazis and the Soviets. And I use the same ones in the book as well as others.
I'm not likening Bush to the Nazis or the Soviets, but go on.
But I think that this magnetic draw towards crises, it's an indicator species that something anti-democratic is going on. Because if you have a political program which enjoys majority support, you don't need crises quite this much. And I think it's more than that. I think that in these cases, we're talking about people, and I do put the true believers of the Chicago School, the Hayeks and the Friedmans, in this category of people who sort of fall in love with the system, a system that looks perfect in their sacred texts. And the problem with people who fall in love with perfect systems, in this case, the idea that if left completely alone, the market would exist in perfect harmony and all of the economic indicators would communicate with each other as some sort of a grand symphony, and any intervention of any kind is marring the beauty of the system. And the problem with people who fall in love with systems, and I absolutely concede the point that there are many leftists who fall in love with a perfect Marxist model in precisely that way, and in many ways, and many people have argued, that the extreme capitalists, many of them are ex-Marxists, that share this sort of thinking patterns of this need for a totalizing perfect system. The problem with that love, which seems idealistic when it's only theoretical, is that reality doesn't comply. It's messy, and you never get that blank slate to create your perfect system. And that's why you need these sort of cleansing shocks, or at least you believe that shocks can play this cleansing role. So the one thing I would add is simply, is there anything new about it? No, there's nothing new about it. What's wrong is that the official story is that this movement has gone hand in hand with democracy. And my whole point in this book is to just decimate that myth.
Well, it's a bit more complicated than that, I suppose, would be the thing. If you suddenly realize that there are people bent on getting explosives onto aircraft to blow them up, and you want to get a machine that detects explosives on passengers, you go to a company that might make that kind of thing. You don't say, let the state do it. You say, who might do this? Let's get a company in. Nothing sinister about that. Completely sensible, isn't it?
Well, I think what you're referring to, the chapter of the book that talks about the war on terror as a new economy. And, you know, I don't think that there's certainly a long history of the government buying defense products from the private sector. And Eisenhower, at the end of his term, warned against the political implications of what he at the time called the military-industrial complex. What I'm arguing in the book is what Eisenhower was saying is, you know, there's nothing necessarily wrong with buying weapons from these companies and giving them markets and rebuilding bridges that have been bombed. We need to be aware that this has become a very powerful lobby that has the ability to put so much pressure on government to protect the market, a market based on destruction, that it can start to shape foreign policy in a dangerous way, i.e. they want war because they need war to expand. That was Eisenhower's warning from a Republican president. You know, that was what was so surprising about that warning. The military-industrial complex has expanded into what I'm calling the disaster capitalism complex. It is so much bigger than what he was talking about. It's not just about bombs. It is really about building an entirely privatized Homeland Security state. The Department of Homeland Security, which the Bush administration launched in the aftermath of September 11th, is a government department unlike any other, in the sense that it is really a hollow shell. There's no one home. The philosophy of the Department of Homeland Security is that its mandate is to protect the United States against any conceivable threat, but it will only purchase products from the private sector, and the solutions have to come from the private sector. So the model it uses is the model of a venture capitalist in the sort of new economy dot-com era, which is to say, okay, look, we need all kinds of security gadgets. We're going to fight a war forever against evil. Okay, that's your business plan, which is a pretty vast business plan. And plus, we are ungoverned by the rules of the marketplace, i.e. we have an unlimited supply of funding. We will deficit spend into generations ahead to fund whatever you can come up with. And that, I think, is very, very dangerous, to have an economy on that scale, now worth $200 billion, that needs a state of constant fear in order to fuel that demand.
But that's a different issue, isn't it? That's the issue of the use to which Mr. Bush is or is not putting the, quote, terrorist threat. That's a different issue.
It's not a different issue, because you asked me, is there something wrong with buying products that can detect devices at airports? And the answer to that is, of course not, but that's not what I'm writing about. I'm writing about the emergence of a new economy based on the war on terror. And that is really a political question. You know, whenever a new economy on a large scale emerges, and I'm arguing that the Homeland Security economy deserves to be treated as seriously as we treated the dot-com economy or the emerging markets of Asia, which is to say, let's talk about it. Let's talk about how it changes the way we make policy, how it changes the way we work, how it changes the way we think. But the problem with this new economy and Homeland Security is that it doesn't brag. This new economy has dot-com levels of wealth, but CIA levels of discretion. So business shows like yours should be debating this all the time, but we don't talk about it as an economy.
We're talking about it now.
Good.
How is this way of doing business different from the Second World War, Franklin Delano Roosevelt turning to Henry Ford, turning to Detroit and saying, we've got to fight Hitler, we want your companies to do the building of the weaponry? How is it different?
I think it's different in the sense that that was more of a three-way collaboration between big government, big business, and labor. So it had a more distributive effect on the economy. If we look at the way billions have been distributed in the aftermath of each of the major recent disasters like Katrina, the tsunami, Iraq, Afghanistan, the way I picture it is as a two-way ATM. Or you have ATMs, cash machines, right?
Yeah.
So the government is this ATM where each disaster frees up billions of dollars, $13 billion for Afghanistan, $40 billion for Iraq, $100 billion for New Orleans. And the corporations withdraw the money, and then they deposit campaign contributions. So rather than delivering good work, right, and this is really the problem, is that the work that's coming out of this contractor model, as we, if we look at Afghanistan, if we look at Iraq, if we look at New Orleans, what do we hear again and again? Reconstruction is stalled. There's nothing happening. You know, in Iraq, you can blame security, but you can't blame a security in New Orleans. And I just got back from there, and it's still rubble. I guess the flip side of it that I'm trying to stress is, while it is inefficient, while it fails to produce decent wages, often exploits workers, and fails to reconstruct, it is enormously profitable. And large parts of the stock market are booming because of this economic model. But what it does do is produce incredible shareholder returns. The truth is, they are probably the safest place to put your money. And I think we need to talk about what it means to have so many people invested in continued fear, instability, climate change, and disaster. Because I think while it's good for a minority of people, for instance, the people getting $14 billion in bonuses in the city, I don't think it's good for a society. I don't think it's healthy to have this much of a society's wealth tied to ongoing disaster.
So that was Naomi Klein on BBC Business Daily. So is capitalism as bad as she paints it? Is American capitalism as bad as she paints it? The United States, after all, is a conspicuously successful economy, perhaps of our times, producing and innovating like no other economy on the planet. One person with strong views on capitalism is Otto Reich, at various times the US ambassador to Venezuela, an assistant secretary of state for the Western Hemisphere, and the president's special envoy for the Western Hemisphere. I asked him what he made of Naomi Klein's argument.
This is a very confused person, you know, who may have studied, but I don't think has quite absorbed the reality of the world economy. I mean, she is described as an anti-globalist, and I think that she probably, don't know whether she even recognizes the existence of the globe. The description of her thesis, if it is that, is to me, as somebody who studied economic development, first is very harmful. It's harmful because it provides yet another excuse for countries that are failing to join the world economy, to failing to make progress.
How so?
Well, you know, it took Latin America decades to get over a similarly harmful theory called dependency theory, which said that the reason why the Latin American countries were underdeveloped and the United States, Europe, Canada, Asia were developed is because the developed countries were exploiting the underdeveloped countries using their natural resources and then transforming them or adding value in the developed world before people realized that the developing world could just as well have manufacturing sites and add value to their products. And politicians got elected to office for decades in Latin America who didn't make progress because they had that excuse. And I certainly hope that they won't use this particular excuse of, you know, disaster capitalism, because I don't think there's such a thing.
Well, except the argument is, whatever she thinks about the Latin American model or whatever, the argument is that companies and ideologues, more to the point, very pro-capitalist ideologues, look at disasters and think they can then pursue their agenda, they can then privatize, as with the agencies after 9/11, for example, huge opportunities for private companies. Is that not true?
Capitalists take advantage of opportunities. I mean, that is one of the definitions of capitalists. It is up to an organized government to regulate capitalism, certainly American capitalism, that which with which I'm most familiar, is highly regulated. People may not realize it, but, you know, we have a highly regulated economy. And people who did take advantage of the Katrina aid unfairly have gone to jail. And in fact, if Katrina shows anything, it is the failure of government. There was a failure of government at every level, at the local level, the city of New Orleans, at the state level, the state of Louisiana, and at the federal level, the federal agency that was charged with emergency relief.
But isn't there an argument that there is an over-close relationship between companies and government through lobbying? And it's certainly not transparent in that in America, companies give shed loads of money to government, and there ain't no such thing as a free lunch. There's payback. Is that not a valid argument?
Only on the surface. It's superficial, because the shed loads of government, of money rather, that you're talking about, lobbying money, goes to influence the Congress. It's the executive branch that implements the assistance programs. They may or may not be implementing the kinds of programs that the lobbyists may want them to implement. And by the way, I believe that there should be much more accountability and transparency in the lobbying laws. But it is completely false to say that capitalists take advantage, or capitalists even are anxious for disaster so they can make more money. It is absolutely correct to say that private companies are much more efficient in responding to any economic activity or any economic or
any
natural.
Any economic activity? No limit to what private companies can do?
In general, private companies are much more efficient. Believe me, I've worked in government. I've spent 15 years in one capacity or another in government and 20 years in private enterprise. And I can tell you that private enterprise is miles ahead of government in terms of responsiveness. Governments are slow. Governments have a very important role to play. They are the cement that keeps the societies together. They have to take care of the people who can't perhaps make it on their own in a market economy. But governments do not respond. And governments, by the way, do not produce things very efficiently. That in the United States, at least, they're not in the production.
The military, you wouldn't outsource the military totally, presumably, would you?
Well, but they don't produce. I mean, the weapons, for example, that the military uses are made by private enterprise.
Or education. That's pretty well done by the state, isn't it?
Yes, and in fact, there are more and more people turning to private education because they have found that the public education system, as good as it is, and I'm a product of the public education system in the United States, as good as it is not good enough for this world, for the kind of competition that we face from other parts of the world. I would much rather see the private companies continue to do what they're doing than have the government become too powerful. I mean, we have seen the opposite. You know, the socialist governments have been a complete failure.
And that was the pro-capitalist Otto Reich. You will have thoughts on that. Send them to world.business@bbc.co.uk.